I'm Laura Murphy-Oates, and this is The Full Story. This week, a decision will be made about Australia's Great Barrier Reef that could shape its future and influence Australia's broader approach to climate change. That decision is whether the World Heritage Committee should list the reef as in danger due to climate change. But what would this move really achieve? And could a lobbying campaign against this listing by the Australian government change the outcome? Today, a historic moment for the fate of the Great Barrier Reef. It's Wednesday, the 21st of July. So, Graeme, you've been doing story after story on the Great Barrier Reef over the past few weeks, and this week it's all coming to a head. Tell me about that.
It is. So there's a big international meeting of the World Heritage Committee where I guess the fate of the Great Barrier Reef, at least in terms of its position on the World Heritage List, is going to be discussed by countries around the world.
Graeme Redfern is an environment reporter at Guardian Australia.
It's a 21-country committee, and its job is to consider all different aspects of world heritage. So you might have heard of UNESCO. It's the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization. And they are the group that advises the World Heritage Committee about what they should do with the natural sites, sites like the Great Barrier Reef that are there because of their natural beauty.
During such times when it might seem that things fall apart, to quote the famous work by Nigerian author Chinua Achebe, preserving heritage is not a luxury. It is a prerequisite for ensuring that things do not fall even further apart.
So the committee meeting, it started last Friday. It's about 15 days long. It's a lot longer than normal. It's meeting virtually and also in the Chinese city of Fuzhou.
Excellences, mesdames et messieurs. This is the very essence of the convention.
There was a speech to kick it off by UNESCO's Director General Audrey Azoulay.
To promote and protect heritage through international solidarity.
Now, Australia is obviously a member of the World Heritage Convention. We've got 20 World Heritage sites. The Great Barrier Reef is one.
Denial should not be an option because we still have the opportunity to act and no time to lose. Treasures could soon disappear. And their loss will then be irremediable.
She talked about the threats that are facing World Heritage sites all around the world, climate change being one, loss of biodiversity being another. She's worried some of these sort of world treasures are in danger of disappearing.
The list of World Heritage in danger is a very valuable tool. It is a call to action.
From Australia's perspective, this whole kerfuffle started because UNESCO has recommended that the Great Barrier Reef be put on the in danger list at this meeting.
So what is an in danger listing and what could it mean for the reef in practical terms?
Well, in practical terms, it doesn't mean a lot. What it could do, according to UNESCO, is become like a rallying cry to the rest of the world that the reef is in danger. Both in official terms and unofficial terms. We think it already is in danger in unofficial terminology. And if you were a small developing country, then that could see you get a bit of money to help with conservation efforts. But Australia doesn't need any money for that sort of work. So what it does do is it would kickstart a process. There would probably be a monitoring mission to the reef. But the listing, in some ways, it is a lever that things like the United Nations can pull on to encourage conservation and to encourage action on all sorts of things.
It kind of applies pressure, basically.
Yeah, that's it. And I mean, UNESCO doesn't really shy away from that either. The aim of the convention is to protect places on Earth that are of an outstanding universal value to humanity. So these are like the planet's jewels, and the convention is there to keep them in the way that they should be. the reasons why sites get put on the in danger list, there's all sorts of reasons. Bad management, could be war, could be a massive explosion, if it's a cultural site, if it's a bunch of buildings. But we've never really seen before a site explicitly placed on the in danger list because of impacts from climate change that have been sort of explicitly identified by UNESCO. So it's sort of a first.
Okay, so I imagine that, you know, the reason that it's been listed because of climate change is because of coral bleaching from rises in sea temperature, which you described at length on a podcast that we did last year. Is that right?
Yeah, that's it. And the UNESCO report talks about that explicitly, these bleaching events in 2016, 2017 and 2020. And they also talk about, well, they want to see Australia's next big policy for the reef kind of acknowledge the Paris climate targets and sort of weave them in to make sure they are part of the response. Because at the moment, there's no real mention of climate targets in the government's response.
So not only are they listing it because of climate change, but they're including a recommendation that we put climate targets at the front of reef conservation. Is that right?
Yeah, they say they want it fully incorporated into our next reef policy. So that also has never really happened before. We've never seen a site put on the in danger list chiefly because of impacts from climate change. They've also got concerns about water quality. We've talked a bit about that before. But yes, this would be a first in the reason it goes on an in danger list, and then also a first in asking a country to explicitly look at its climate targets as part of its response.
I mean, this is pretty shameful and embarrassing, really, having these types of firsts to our name.
I think that's how Australia definitely sees it. Their response suggests that they really do not want this to happen.
I will stand up in any community, and I do, and say that we have the best managed reef in the world, the gold standard, and no one has contradicted me yet.
Within hours of the documents being placed, they said they were completely blindsided by that recommendation.
This decision was flawed. Clearly there were politics behind it. Clearly those politics have subverted a proper process.
The Environment Minister, Susan Lee, has said that her officials were given an assurance that that wouldn't be happening in the months leading up to those documents being released.
And for the World Heritage Committee to not even foreshadow this listing is, I think, appalling.
So our Environment Minister says that she was blindsided and that UNESCO doesn't actually have all the facts at hand to make this type of recommendation. Is that a fair comment from her?
In some ways, maybe, but no, not really. She says that UNESCO gave her department some assurances that this recommendation would not be made, but UNESCO denies ever doing that. So if we put that part of the being surprised to one side and look more generally, we've known these threats have been facing the reef. So in some ways, maybe Susan Lee thinks she was blindsided, but the rest of sort of the conservation community certainly says this has been coming for ages.
I also heard Susan Lee make some statements about the fact that she believed the decision to list the reef as in danger had been politicised. What did she mean by that, Graham?
She didn't articulate exactly what she meant by that, but I think that what they're getting at is that Australia's being picked on.
There are 82 other properties that are also recognised as being high or very high risk of climate change. If they all came on to this as a job lot, I might understand it, but they've actually just picked one, right, and that's Australia, to make an international point without recognising the really good work that we've done.
Some of the Australian media, particularly sort of the News Corp media, there was a few stories where, with no attribution, they said that the Australian government was basically saying this was China.
China chairs this group. Do you think that this is retaliation for Australia's stance on other things like COVID and finding out the cause?
The technical nature of the decision-making, the sudden listing, if you like, or recommendation for listing has surprised me. But I'm not going to comment on what has gone on behind the scenes. These are international organisations, and they have, you know, there is a lot of play, as we know, in any international system.
But remembering here, the decision to recommend the in danger listing didn't come from the World Heritage Committee. It came from the advice of Australia's own government and UNESCO and IUCN. That's the International Union for Conservation of Nature. In any case, I asked UNESCO's officials about this and they rejected it absolutely out of hand.
After UNESCO denied this, that the decision has been politicised, did the Environment Minister backtrack at all?
No, they just sent a response, said they stand by their comments and their position. I also asked the department for any evidence that they'd been given an assurance, for example, by UNESCO that this wasn't going to happen. So, you know, that would explain the government's, this phrase the government's had, which is they were blindsided by the whole thing because they'd been told that this was not going to happen. So I said, can you show me anything that would illustrate that you got this guarantee? And they haven't come forth with anything. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but they haven't provided it.
Why would the government react like this, do you think? I mean, what is at stake here for them?
It's definitely a reputational thing for Australia. They've gone on this kind of all-out global lobbying mission.
What is that involved?
There was a letter that came out only days after, a letter to the World Heritage Centre, essentially complaining about concerns about process. And that letter was signed by Australia and a bunch of other countries. And that is kind of an indication that Australia straight away is sort of trying to get the ball rolling on pressure on the World Heritage Centre and on the UNESCO and on the World Heritage Committee. They said the recommendations should be based on transparent, extensive and close consultation processes, and that they all held concerns over the process.
So basically, hold your horses, do another visit, look a bit closer here, is the gist of the letter.
Yes.
Were there any big names of the countries that signed on to this?
Yeah, you had Canada, you had the UK, France. Importantly, you also had Spain and Hungary, that are actually two countries that are on the World Heritage Committee. Now, does that mean that those countries will vote in favour of any amendments that Australia might put? Well, we actually don't know. They are probably also referring to their own sites. I mean, it's not just Australia that has got a truck with UNESCO at the moment. You also have countries that are trying to get sites on the World Heritage List. The reef's been on the World Heritage List since the 1980s, but you have some countries such as Thailand, for example, that also signed that letter. They've been trying to get a site on the World Heritage List for many years now. So, you know, they've all got a bit of skin in the game here.
So our government writes this letter and a bunch of countries, for whatever reason, kind of get behind it. Has that been the extent of our lobbying on this issue?
No. lots and lots of other things. Quite expensive things too, I think. So Susan Lee flew to Europe last week. We don't know a lot about what she's been doing over there, but we know that she went to Hungary, to Budapest. Hungary is a member of the World Heritage Committee. Yeah, we know she was in Paris and she met a senior official at UNESCO. But while she's been over there, the government invited ambassadors from 13 countries and the EU, who are all based in Canberra. They all flew up to Cairns and they had a day snorkeling on the reef with the government's reef envoy, the MP Warren Ench. They went to Agincourt Reef, which is a reef off Port Douglas and is only obviously one of about, there's about 3,000 reefs on the Great Barrier Reef, individual reefs. So, you know, you don't really get a good idea from dropping in on one reef. But there it is. They had a day snorkeling with Warren Ench.
Okay, so we've seen this international letter campaign. We've had ambassadors flown into the reef. We've had Susan Lee flying around Europe. This is a lot of activity by this government in the lead up to this meeting. Is this normal behaviour?
For Australia, it is normal, yes. For anyone that's been around this game for a while, there's a distinct feeling of deja vu.
Next, Australia's predictable playbook and what it could mean for the future of the reef. Okay, so tell me about this history between UNESCO and the Great Barrier Reef.
So in the early sort of 2010s, there was noises that the reef was going to be put on the endangered list.
Mm.
There were a bunch of major gas projects that were being proposed. They were going to build a huge gas facility on Curtis Island, and they were going to have to dredge for a lot of that. Basically, you are scouring large areas of the seabed to make it deep enough to get big LNG ships in. This was going to impact areas within the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park. And not only that, there were continued problems, as there still are, with runoff from essentially sugarcane farms and grazing properties in the catchments, in the rivers that flow into the reef, where you were getting a lot of sediment. And that news got back to UNESCO and they were not happy about it.
Mm. Right. So this led UNESCO to step in about 5 years ago. What happened?
Yeah. So they threatened an endanger list.
Mm.
Australian ambassadors around the world were talking to their colleagues in all sorts of different countries to try and say this should not be happening. The reef cannot be placed on the endanger list. They even flew in a bunch of international journalists for a trip on the reef.
Like a little helicopter tourism.
Like a little junket for journals to come in and then go back to their international outlets and write about how awesome the reef is.
Look how alive it is and still here.
Yeah, that's right. Now, of course, you know, you can't assess the health of a 2,300-kilometre long reef by visiting one spot. There's thousands of reefs, and you can still find many, many, many awesome areas. But anyway, importantly, the lobbying mission aside, the threat of the endanger listing did was force the Australian government to come up with a plan. It's now called the Reef 2050 Plan. It had all sorts of water quality targets attached to it. The threat of the endanger listing also forced the government of the time to ban dredging in the Reef Marine Park area. So you can see how UNESCO had this stick or this lever that it pulled, and the threat was, we will put this site on the endanger list if you don't start to do something. And things happened, and that averted the threat for a few years until now.
What did the government do in the time while that stick was hanging over them to show that they were actually acting on this and caring for the reef in the right way?
They established a load of targets to reduce runoff. They limited and, in most cases, banned this dredging. They committed to like 5 yearly evaluations of the performance of these sort of plans. And that was enough for UNESCO and for the World Heritage Committee to hold off on that endanger listing.
And what happened after these measures were put in place to save the reef?
Well, the World Heritage Committee last considered the reef in 2015, and since then we've had 3 mass bleaching outbreaks. Even before that 2020 mass bleaching event, the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority released a report. They said the long-term outlook for the reef had gone from poor to very poor before we get this sort of third really widespread bleaching. Now, that is caused by rising ocean temperatures. This is happening everywhere on the planet. It's because we're burning too many fossil fuels and we're warming the atmosphere and we're warming the oceans.
Considering this widespread and horrendous damage that you've just outlined, I'm wondering if Australia's conservation efforts that they put in place after 2015 did anything at all.
A lot of the measures that Australia can put in place locally, and that is stuff around water quality, the idea is that you get the reefs in their strongest position. You get them as healthy as you possibly can so that if and when bleaching happens, that they are ready to sort of combat that. That's the sort of thinking. But it's been an awful time for the reef, and that is exactly what we were told would happen as global temperatures went up and greenhouse gas emissions kept going up.
Is it kind of like tending the garden, but it's on fire?
Yeah.
Is that the situation that we're in?
I don't know. Maybe it's like pulling weeds out of your garden bed when behind you someone is coming in with a large SUV and just driving straight over the top of your marigolds.
And here the SUV is climate change, in case people didn't get that.
a hastily constructed metaphor there.
So, as you mentioned, the actual decision to do this in danger listing is all coming to a head this week with the World Heritage Committee. What would that look like? How does that process work?
It feels on the face of it like, oh, there's a vote and they'll either say yes or no. But all sorts of things could happen. So, for example, Australia cannot post sort of suggested amendments to the committee on its own site, right?
What do you mean by that? What is this amendment process?
It's just a change. It's something that will go before the committee that says, well, we don't like that part of it, but we do like this bit. And we've suggested some changes. So it's got Saudi Arabia and Bahrain to do it on their own behalf.
They're interesting partners for us to go to.
Yeah. I mean, some commentators have made the point that Saudi Arabia in particular, obviously another country that relies heavily on fossil fuels. Of course, Australia is also a major fossil fuel exporter with its coal and with its liquefied natural gas. So the amendment would delay by almost a year a report that the government needs to send to UNESCO, and then would also delay a potential decision on the in danger listing until 2023.
So that's kicking a few cans pretty far down the road, that sounds like.
It is. What we might also see is just the committee might just reject that out of hand and vote on the recommendation that's right before it now from UNESCO.
Mm. And what does that voting process look like?
It's actually rare for them to have a vote. Normally, it's just done by consensus.
Right. So there's some kind of backroom meetings and they all go, are you voting that? You're going to do that? And they come out and say what they're going to do.
Yeah. It could get quite complicated, but you're looking at either a simple majority or a two-thirds majority, depending on the route the decision takes before it gets voted on.
So, Graham, as we know, if the reef does get listed as in danger due to climate change, that would be a world first. And I'm wondering, what do you see happening after that? Because I imagine it would put enormous pressure on our government, not just over the conservation of the reef, but also on our broad approach to climate change as a country.
Yeah, so there's something really interesting here. We were talking about the amendment, you know, the changes that Australia wants to see to this document. And of course, one is scrub out the line that says put the reef on the in danger list. But it does not scrub out the section that says Australia's reef plan should be in line with the Paris Agreement on climate change.
Mm, that commitment to targets that we spoke about, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that means that UNESCO is asking a country to get its act together on climate in line with the Paris Agreement in order to save a site from going in the in danger list. And in danger means that it is facing peril, that it is going to be eroded from what it once was.
So Australia looked at this amendment and left the bit about climate targets in, basically.
Yeah.
Does that show that this process has already applied quite a bit of pressure? That's shifted the dial.
Oh, yeah, it has shifted the dial. And that's what international conventions are all about. It's trying to hold countries to line, to try and bring them out to progress actions on all sorts of issues. And this convention is to save the most important places on the planet. So even this process, whatever happens later this week, it has seen Australia forced into putting climate change and its response as part of the sort of multi-billion dollar policy to conserve the Great Barrier Reef. I live in Queensland. I snorkeled on one of the reefs just a few weeks ago. I got my camera under the water, saw some awesome things. I saw a school, like a traffic jam of silverfish wash straight over the top of me. There's corals all over the place. It is super cool. It's an experience like no other. It's truly, truly remarkable because it is a truly remarkable place. And that's the thing that we have to keep reminding ourselves in amongst all the politics and the lobbying and the policy responses. You know, it is a unique, unbelievable, beautiful place. And the idea that that place is starting to fall apart is, for many people, heartbreaking.
That was environment reporter Graham Redfern. The Great Barrier Reef listing is currently scheduled to come before the committee on Friday early evening Australia time, but it's possible that it could come earlier. Graham will be following that closely, so do check out his reporting, including a great piece from yesterday revealing that an international lineup of actors, conservationists and scientists, including Aquaman himself, Jason Momoa, plus actress Joanna Lumley, have backed calls for the Great Barrier Reef to be listed as in danger. You can read that at theguardian.com and we've linked it on the full story page as well. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Jane Lee and Camilla Hannon, who also did the sound design. Additional production by Joe Koning, Alison Chan, Karishma Luthria, and Ellen Lee Beater. The executive producers of Full Story are Miles Muttignoni, Gabrielle Jackson, and myself, Laura Murphy-Oates. Okay, catch you tomorrow.